Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. Righteousness is not whether you turn your face towards east or west, but righteousness is to believe in Allah, the last day, the angels, the books, and the prophets.
What kind of father would demand the death of a son? Is this a god? Or is it an ogre? Is it a monster created by our own violent impulses? We project, so this is God who wants vengeance like we want vengeance. There are contradictory images of God in the Bible. On which one will we model our lives?
We committed ourselves to building the world as it should be. So tonight, in honor of my father's memory and my daughter's future, out of gratitude for those whose triumphs we mark this week, and those whose everyday sacrifices have brought us to this moment, let us devote ourselves to finishing their work. Let us work together to fulfill their hopes, and let's stand together to elect Barack Obama.
All right, turn it off.
All right,
that's the new Michelle Obama. That's the new. I don't have to use very different words now. What do they spray? Whatever. Photo retouched Michelle Obama. The real Michelle Obama is something else. Welcome to the Savage Nation. At first, we heard the invocation at the DNC, which was a Muslim praying to Allah, which is quite interesting because yesterday they talked about God. Today it was Allah. Now, I don't know whether Allah and God are the same. I do hope they are, and I hope we can all get together because I, like Rodney King, really do want us all to get together and play together in the big sandbox of America. But I kind of doubt it, given that we have men walking around without arms, legs, eyes, nose, teeth. We have over 3,000 men lying in dark, cold holes because they fought the forces that have hijacked Allah. So you understand that I'm a little nervous when I hear the Democrat Party have a Muslim do the invocation, particularly in a nation that was founded not on the Muslim faith, but upon the Judeo-Christian origins of the founders of the United States of America. Now, the transformation of Michelle Obama is the topic today on the Savage Nation. Welcome if you have just joined us. We're talking about the astounding transformation of Michelle Obama and also the political plankton who have been made to walk the plank. Now, what do I mean by that? What does Michael Savage mean by this clever use of political plankton walking the plank? Well, again, go to michaelsavage.com for the full monologue, which I'm about to read to you, and also to see my new great autobiography, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. I want to talk, though, about the convention. You know, last night, Michelle Obama was transformed completely. The speech she gave at the DNC, the convention, was the same bland, hackneyed message that is now demanded of all Obama supporters at this convention. This is not the Michelle Obama we know. This is not the Michelle Obama who introduced her husband, quote, as her baby's daddy. This is not the Michelle Obama who said she was proud of America only for the first time in her life. But if you think Michelle Obama is being attacked because of her race, you are wrong. And let me give you an example. Let's look at Condoleezza Rice. Many conservatives, myself primarily, and liberals disagree with Condoleezza Rice. But there isn't the same fundamental discomfort about Condoleezza Rice, who she is, as there is with Michelle Obama. But there is a fundamental difference between how Rice makes you feel and how Obama makes you feel. Rice, despite her politics and ineptitude, does not evoke or project anger or hostility. But Michelle Obama does provoke and evoke anger and hostility. Now, what's the difference between them? I'll let the Savage Nation decide. I've already said it. One provokes and evokes anger and hostility. The other does not. I don't like Rice's politics. But I watch her. I have no visceral reaction to Condoleezza Rice because she doesn't project anger. She doesn't project hostility. Michelle Obama does. You could see it in her eyes. Anyone who knows people knows this woman's full of hate. Period. End of story. The same is not true about Condoleezza Rice. So don't give me the race story. I will criticize anyone in the political arena or I'll leave radio. And she is not above the law. And this is why the Democrats have felt the need to transform Michelle Obama. Now, why should we care about her? Because she's the commander-in-chief's bedmate, pillow talk, number one advisor, co-president. We're electing the wife as much as the husband. All her rough edges were smoothed out. Instead, Michelle talked about public service and community volunteers and the American dream. It was no longer a dark, horrible nation where people of color were knocked down by white men. Oh, no, it was a loving nation, a hopeful nation. But all of that former extremism was swept under the rug. All the far-left rhetoric of Michelle's was pushed to the side. And that, frankly, is the hallmark of the Democrats' convention. And by the way, to be fair, as it will probably be for the Republican convention next week, all of the juicy people are being kept out of the limelight. The raving left-wing lunatic nun, Helen Prejean, who I played on this show yesterday, wasn't even allowed to speak at the convention itself. She spewed her hatred for America and the military and at white people at a, quote, interfaith gathering that took place in Denver a day before the official start of the convention. She'll be found nowhere at the main gathering. None of the political plankton have been given a plank at this convention. In fact, the political plankton has been told to walk the plank. Yet they reveal the true character of the Democrats. Listen to what I just said to you. It is the political plankton that reveals the true inner mind, inner soul, inner workings of the Democrats, as it will be with the Republicans. And so while the cable networks are watching whales, focusing only on the balloons and the big screen TVs, I, Michael Savage, will be putting the plankton of the party under a microscope and giving you his analysis, my analysis. Now, of course, Jesse High Jackson, Al Sharpton, Cornel West, Reverend Wright, and Angela Davis will not be seen at the convention. Jesse Jackson is being put under wraps for his comment about cutting off Obama's you-know-what. Al Sharpton is seen as a street hustler who made Kerry look like more of a fool than he is. So he's out too. Cornel West has been locked out of the convention because he made a career of forcing far-left ideology down the throats of college students at Harvard. Angela Davis makes people think of afros and AKs, and that strikes a little too close to home when it comes to last night's keynote speaker. This is why the transformation of Michelle Obama took place. This is why the plankton have been made to walk the plank. And this is why what you see this week at the Democrat convention is the modern equivalent of Soviet troops marching past Lenin's tomb. No dissidents, no disruptions, just disinformation. This is the Savage Nation, and I approve of this monologue. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I have a lot more to say on the show today, and I don't want to do it all in one opening because I could do it in one opening and then burn myself out. Instead, I want to slow down. I want to slow down, and I want to talk about something else. You know, I come on the show on the air late in the day on the East Coast. It's early evening on the East Coast, and it's late in the afternoon on the West Coast and somewhere in between in the middle of America. And by this time, most of you have seen a little bit of the convention. You've clicked on a TV or you've heard it on radio. And I knew that this week would be the Democrat convention. I knew that next week would be the Republican convention, of course. And I also knew that you'd be bored to death if all I did was play their speeches and comment on them. Now, I could do that, but I'd get burned out. It would be like watching the American bombers bombing Serbia for 82 days. I can't do this. And that's why I rushed, killed myself, burned my eyes out to produce the Psychological Nudity Savage Autobiography, at least to get it up on the website by yesterday, because I wanted to read from it. I wanted to talk about it. I want to switch from politics to storytelling. And I'll tell you why, because I'm a great storyteller. Now, all of the stories in my book are true. Every last one of them, every word, every paragraph, every comma is true. But I have been told that storytelling is a lost art in America. And frankly, it's true. I don't know who else in America. Put aside my politics. There are millions of listeners to this show who don't agree with my politics at all, who tell me, through smaller numbers, of course, that they listen because they love my stories. That's why they listen to this show. They say, you know what, I don't agree with you, but truthfully, I like you. I disagree with you. I like you because, you know, you're this, you're that. At least you know what you're talking about. And it makes me solidify my viewpoints. But I really love when you tell me stories about when you were a kid growing up in America. Or when you were starting out in radio. Or even what's going on in your life right now when you walk around San Francisco. And that's why I wrote Psychological Nudity. Now, I have to tell you, what has happened already has made me feel really good. You flooded onto michaelsavage.com. The orders are pouring in. And I'm really happy. I'm fulfilled. And I will tell you again, it's not going to change my lifestyle. I don't wear bling. I don't need anything. Most of what is left over is going to go for a worthy cause. I'll tell you that right now. What it is, I don't know. It might go to a dog thing. I know Teddy is such a star of this cover, my dog, that last night I didn't know what to do for him. I offered to buy him a fur coat, and I thought that would be cruel to buy a fur coat for a dog. I mean, what, kill an animal for an animal? I offered to feed him food that I normally don't feed him. He looked at me like I was crazy. He said, I eat well, or what do you want from me? I eat good anyway. What are you going to give me a meal for? I didn't know what to do for him, which is why we love our pets. It's like having a bum in the house. I've told you that before. The reason we love pets, it's like having a hippie living with you. They don't do anything, but they're charming. They hang around. Whatever you want to do, it's okay. You sleep, they sleep. You go to the bathroom, they're next to the toilet. You go in a shower, they want to go in a shower. You go on a walk, they're going to walk. You yawn, they yawn. You sigh, they sigh. You cry, they look sad. It's like having a hippie freeloader in the house. And there's not much you can do for them. They don't want very much. And that's why they are man's best friend. And that's truthfully what I hope my book Psychological Nudity will become for you. Your best friend, because I wrote it for generations to come. And I have to say again, do you know that my first book, 1972, Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, was published by Macmillan Publishing? Do you know that that book is still in print somewhere? I write Persian miniatures. I don't just do a cover with empty pages with large words, as do most people in radio. I don't write a book just to make money. My heart and soul is in this one. And as John Burroughs, the great American naturalist, said, if you bait your hook with your heart, the fish will always bite. And I do hope you enjoy the worm. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I heard last night the most remarkable speech I have heard in my entire career in the offensive.
Hell yeah, we can believe that. Now, hold on. This is Joe Biden, the smokestack era man who's going to bring change to America. Even though he's been in the Senate for 500 years, he's going to bring change to America, and he stands for something new. And he says that he heard the most remarkable speech he's ever heard in his life, and he's not engaging in hyperbole talking about the vanilla speech of Michelle Obama. Her speech was eloquent and profound. Come on, no one knows a word she said. Can anyone tell me one word or one phrase Michelle spouted last night that you'll ever remember? I mean, like, don't ask, it's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Something along those lines. Something. The Gettysburg Address, we're not asking for. How about the Denver Address? The Denver Address of someone literate who can write a speech, for example. We don't need the Gettysburg Address. Just give me the Denver Address. It's astounding. Illiteracy passes for genius today. Now, I don't know how any Democrat can't be alarmed right now at what you're listening to, but you're listening to gibberish. Even Democrats are shocked by the gibberish. So far, nothing has been said. They stand for nothing. They're trying to be so bland. They have airbrushed out everybody who can say something that they really mean. And what you have here is a view of America that's quite frightening. New York, Denise, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was just going to say about the speech, first of all, I love your show, but about the speech, I wanted to listen with an open heart, but I ended up feeling insulted by it. To me, it was like somebody at an interview who was talking it up really well but didn't have the credentials to back up what they were saying. In other words, talk is cheap. And all of a sudden, she loves America. What about what she said before? You mean we're supposed to forget that? It just seemed like...
You know, I would rather that she was the flaming woman she is. If she has distrust for white people and distrust for America, even though she's been treated very well, she ought to say it and just go with it. I mean, what's the point of hiding who she is? People don't trust what she said. There are plenty of people who distrust America, and not all of them are not white either. And so if that's what her feelings are, why didn't she just express them? What would have happened? People would have thanked her for it.
It was insincere, in my opinion. I just...
Well, that's the whole point. Isn't that the whole point of my talking about it today? Do we expect sincerity from politicians? No. But we expect the ability to project sincerity when they don't mean it. They're not even good actors. But listen, if you think this is bad, you've seen nothing yet. Wait till the Republicans next week. And as I said to you, the plankton on the left have been made to walk the plank. You can just imagine who's not going to be speaking or seen or heard when McCain gets up there. We still don't know who his vice presidential pick is going to be. I mean, I'm not going to be there. Could you imagine the hay that the media would make if Michael Savage was anywhere within the vicinity of Minneapolis? I mean, I probably won't even be allowed to fly over the city when McCain is there. Never mind speak. I wouldn't expect that. I won't even be able to enter Minneapolis. There's probably some kind of cordon sanitaire around Minneapolis that prohibits all conservative talk shows from arriving there. I found out there are people at the convention. I don't know what they're doing in Denver. Just where you want to be in August is Denver. And by the way, what happened to the vigorous protests we heard about with detention camps and batons and horses? I thought it was going to be like the Democrat convention with Abby Hoffman in the 70s. I was getting ready to see some good action with real screaming, hey, hey, ho, hoers. There was nothing there. Where are they? Where are the protesters? Now, there's an ad running around that's been banned by Fox News and CNN. It's an anti-Obama ad, and Obama is seeking to silence this ad, tying him to the 60s radical Bill Ayers. In fact, they're threatening all stations that run it. Since we have not been threatened, we're not going to run the ad right now. We're going to take a break. And then in the minute I come back, unless the letter comes within the 5 minutes of the ad, we are going to run the ad that's been banned by Fox News and CNN that the Obama people are banning. Texas billionaire Harold Simmons, who was one of the main funders of the Truthful Swift Boat Veterans for the Truth, who targeted the fraud Kerry, contributed nearly $2.9 million to the American Issues Project, who created this ad tying Obama to the radical Ayers. We are going to run it on the Savage Nation and ask you if you think this ad should be banned from the media. I hope they don't send us a letter within the next 5 minutes because I'm running it.
Savage.
It is 34 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Savage Nation. We have not gotten a letter from the Obama campaign, which they have sent around the country, banning this ad. Fox News wouldn't run it. CNN wouldn't run it. And it says that any station that follows will get a similar response from people who don't want the political discourse cheapened with these false negative attacks. I have no idea how Obama thinks he can impose censorship on an ad. It seems they protest a bit too much. Methinks they protest a little too much. There's something in this ad that's too close to home for Obama for them to be threatening censorship. Because it ties Obama to Bill Ayers, now a professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. They both live in Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood, et cetera. But you got to understand that Obama was the first chairman of the Chicago Annenberg Challenge, a school reform group of which Ayers was a founder. And Ayers also held a Meet the Candidate event at his home for Obama when Obama first ran for office in the mid-90s. Now, who is Bill Ayers? Why are they trying to bury it? And why is the American Issues Project putting out this ad? Let's listen to it.
Beyond the speeches, how much do you know about Barack Obama? What does he really believe? Consider this. United 93 never hit the Capitol on 9/11. But the Capitol was bombed 30 years before by an American terrorist group called Weather Underground that declared war on the U.S., targeting the Capitol, the Pentagon, police stations, and more. One of the group's leaders, William Ayers, admits to the bombings, proudly saying later, "We didn't do enough." Some members of the group Ayers founded even went on to kill police. But Barack Obama is friends with Ayers, defending him as, quote, respectable and mainstream. Obama's political career was launched in Ayers' home, and the two served together on a left-wing board. Why would Barack Obama be friends with someone who bombed the Capitol and is proud of it? Do you know enough to elect Barack Obama? American Issues Project is responsible for the content of this ad.
Now, in a letter to station managers, Obama campaign lawyer Robert Bauer wrote the following. He said, quote, your station is committed to operating in the public interest, an objective that cannot be satisfied by accepting for compensation material of such malicious falsity. Now, I'd be perfectly willing to run any Obama ad that he wants to launch against McCain. In the Obama campaign's own response to this ad, an announcer states, and there is an ad, quote, with all our problems, why is John McCain talking about the 60s, trying to link Barack Obama to radical Bill Ayers? McCain knows Obama denounced Ayers' crimes committed when Obama was just 8 years old, close quote. McCain's spokesman countered and said the fact that Barack Obama chose to launch his political career at the home of an unrepentant terrorist raises more questions about Senator Obama's judgment than any TV ad ever could, close quote. Now, we know that people change. I changed. I mean, maybe Bill Ayers is a Boy Scout today. I don't know. I think he said he isn't. I think he said he wished he could have killed more, if I remember correctly. I don't know. Maybe he runs a Boy Scout troop now. I have no idea what he does. There's a famous civil rights leader, shakedown artist who once spit in the food of white people. He doesn't do that anymore. He changed. There's another civil rights leader who once used a bullhorn outside Freddie's Fashion Mart and egged on a crowd that burnt down a store in Harlem saying the Jews own it. And seven people died. He's on Fox News. Nice suit, nice haircut. So people do change. So I'm not certain that Obama really believes that Bill Ayers is still a radical bomb thrower. But should the ad be banned, I mean, is the question. Now, look, I told you I can't just do this 3 hours a day. You'll go crazy and so will I. So I'm going to leaven this with Michael Savage radio stories, which you can find in the Savage autobiography, and you can buy it at michaelsavage.com only. It is not in the stores. It probably won't be in the stores this year, if ever. It's only for you. And I'm going to press with it next Tuesday. I have to find the number that I need to print. I still don't know. So, honest to God, you're not going to get it till late October, early November, which is for the holidays. I know it's crazy. Labor Day, and already you're thinking ahead. It's the way people get when they get older. You start thinking ahead. You better think ahead. Now, listen to this story because it comes from my book. 5 o'clock, like clockwork, after a hard day in high school, my mother, God bless her, would put a tray out for me. Oh, was I spoiled. I'm making up for it. Now I'm working my butt off, but the tray, the steak, the French fries, I'm talking French fries. Steak, French fries. Here's the diet I had, the healthful diet. Breakfast was ham and eggs with a jelly donut. Lunch was something light, like a meatloaf sandwich with French fries. Dinner was something light, like either steak or pot roast with some heavy potato dish, topped off with the health-enhancing cherry vanilla ice cream and a piece of pie. And maybe a glass of milk to go with it, and possibly a... This went on for years. Now, if I were designing an experiment to kill a child... Now, I'm not suggesting that that's what was going on here. If I were to design an experiment, a cardiotoxic diet to kill a pig in a laboratory, I'd give him that diet for like three months. The pig would roll over and drop dead of an occlusion. I don't know. I'm still kicking. So it has something to do with nothing to do with. You know, it has something to do with nothing to do with it. Now, admittedly, because my father, may rest in peace, died of a heart attack young, and my grandfather, then I was like reaching. Well, what about great-grandfather back in the old country? I was hanging on the hope that he lived to 103. Oh, he too died at 39. Oh, thank you. Three generations dead. I'm the oldest living savage in the history of the family. So every day is like a miracle. Well, that's why I went into nutrition. That's why I searched for the secret to longevity for years in the jungles of the South Seas. Go on my website, see if I'm making it up. I'm one of the original ethnobotanists in the field. And what I discovered is very, very little is known. But what is known is very important. Which vitamins you take and in what proportions. All right, you get the picture. The vitamin part I left out. The story part was funny. So that's in Psychological Nudity. And I, you know, rewrote it for the – it's still funny. I laughed at it because I still don't know how it worked. All I know is that when Dad came home, I could to this day remember, God rest his soul, and I'm not trying to mock my parents. God bless them both. They were wonderful people. I really mean it. What a struggle it must have been to be a new immigrant to America and how confusing it was. New language, no education. That's why I empathize with the immigrants in America. And I, you know, you don't believe it. Here's a man for against illegal immigration. You think I'm a mean guy, but I look at them and I see me, I see their kids, I see myself, I see the guy playing soccer in the field, you know, in a different language, a different skin color, it's my father. I mean, I understand this. People don't comprehend this about me. But that's okay. There's a lot of confusion in the world. I don't expect you to know me. That doesn't mean we should let them become citizens because they're nice guys and they want to get ahead. The country is full. The lifeboat is full. The water is coming over the gun walls. We don't have the social net for our own people. The hospitals are broken. The schools are broken. The roads are broken. The legal system is broken. The government is broken. We have no more room. Sorry, please go home. That's different than what they're trying to say we're saying about the illegal immigrants. Don't you understand? So it must have been hard for Dad. I mean, you know, you know how hard it was for him? He had nothing. He started out with a push cart in New York. I'm not ashamed to say it. A push cart. He told me that he drove a horse-drawn wagon when he was 13 to make some money. I don't know what it was. A laundry wagon. And here's this little kid, you know, with a big horse pulling a laundry wagon on the cobblestone streets. It sounds like 1,000 years ago. And he said he braked the horse and the horse bucked and he fell forward and a spike went through his foot. Amazing. You know, you talk about it, it sounds like another universe, another world. Well, he had to work his way up from the streets to owning a little store. And then he owned a little store and he was able to buy a little brick attached house for $14,500 in 1952. And that remained the shelter for my mother long after my father went to the next world. And then she sold it and moved to Florida. But that little brick house was our fortress. It was a golden palace to me. I didn't want for more. I looked at nicer houses. They looked nice to me. But what's the difference what walls you live behind? I knew that as a youngster. As long as you have a roof over your head and you have parents who love you and you have food and you have relatives who come over, how can it be any better than that? It can't be. How many broken hearts are there in mansions in Beverly Hills? How many empty, I have a choice word I'd like to use, cougars are there out there who live in huge houses in Nassau County hunting for the next lover who's 20 years old? You're telling me that woman is happy, the cougar with the injected lips? I don't think so. So, you know, you've heard all of these things before. They're all homilies. But the fact of the matter is they're not homilies. They're realities. And whether you like the story or not is entirely up to your orientation. If you are a God-fearing person who believes in family and patriotism in America, you'll love my book. If you're an atheist who thinks that God doesn't exist and you despise the military and you think cops are evil, don't buy my book. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Back. You know, it's an interesting world we're all living in so many ways. When you look at the hybrid cars, you know, you start to think, look, I have high-powered cars, a lot of them, from my old, from phenomenal, you know, 7-liter, 65 caddy convertible. That thing's a storm. Old technology, it stinks, but it's fast as a rocket for a big, fat car. Then I got a big, fat Mercedes, a 600S, a 12-cylinder. The thing is a rocket ship, 0 to 60 in 4.5. I have another, you know, I'm not going to hide it. I have a Ferrari. The thing is a rocket. I never drive it. It's got 1,600 miles on it after 2 years. Are Dennis Kucinich speaking? No. Wait, let me finish this better than that loser. I don't know how he got up there, that homeless moron. Let me hear a minute of him.
In Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, nobody.
Turn it off. I heard enough already with him, that lunatic hysteric. He sounds like Frito. Wait, let me hear it again.
Hot war with Iran.
Now, why does he sound like Frito in The Godfather? Play Frito. Play Frito if you can find it.
Say Frito playing. Off to do this. Say Frito off to do that. Let Frito take care of some Mickey Mouse nightclub somewhere. I can handle things. I'm smart. Not like everybody says. Like dumb. I'm smart. And I want to
take the gold. World
I
records.
Swear to you.
World records for violations.
Did I not pick up on a gestalt here? A verbal gestalt that Dennis Kucinich is the Frito of the Democrat convention.
Inheritance and hollow out the economy. We cannot afford another Republican administration.
Send Frito off of there.
These companies took over health care. Wake up, America.
Send Fredo up to do this. Send Fredo up to do that.
Wake up, America.
Let Fredo take care of some Mickey Mouse nightclubs.
Wake up, America. They want your social security. Wake up, America. Multinational corporations took over our trade policies. Factories are closing.
I can handle things. I'm smart.
Wake up, America. We went into Iraq. War against Iran will mean $10 a gallon gasoline. The oil administration, they want to drill more into your wallet. Wake up, America. Contract.
All right. Shut up. Get him out of here, boo. Give him the hook. They want to drill more into your wallet, you putz. The reason we want to drill more is to reduce the cost of oil, Schmendrick. What up? This is an idiot. Lowest. I don't know how they let this plankton onto the stage with the whales there. You know, what a moron this guy is. He makes me. But you got to admit that the mix between him and Dennis Kucinich and Fredo was really good. It was one of the fine moments of radio. I really enjoyed that. Is he still talking? Let me hear more.
Well, the cost of food, gasoline, and electricity skyrocket.
Shut up. You don't look like
now
you're starving
have
to me.
Skillfully
get up. Get him off this. Yeah, take it. Tell your story, Walken Johnson. Get out of here. Let me hear. Just one more second. I can't resist. It's like drawing in the air on a tooth, like a filling that fell out. Let me hear one more.
I can handle things. I'm smart.
No. Dennis Kucinich. Dennis.
Dennis. The insurance companies.
All right. He's anti-corporate. Yeah. How many corporations support this bum? I don't understand it because he has a very good-looking wife. That's the part that bothers me. What is it about women that they're attracted to weasels like him? I could never understand this. The guy is ugly. He's a psychopath. He's a left-winger. How he got him, I'll never understand this. But then, look, a lot of women look good and inside they're insecure children. So what are you going to do? Maybe let's not go there. Let me not fantasize. I'm not interested in his sex life. Before I was so rudely interrupted by my own machinations here with Dennis Kucinich and Fredo Corleone, I was saying that I have cars with big engines. Okay, it's my business. I pay for the gas. You don't. Okay, so don't lecture me about what I should be doing. And here's what I'm getting at. You idiots with these Toyota hybrids, at first you say, you know what? Hey, what's wrong with cutting down on emissions? No one likes emissions. It turns out that the batteries for these cars cannot be recycled in any way. They're going to wind up polluting the earth for as long as maybe 1,000 years. There's no way to recycle them right now. They have to create whole new dumps for the nickel batteries or whatever they're using in these Toyota hybrids. It came out in Australia that they cannot get rid of them. Did you hear what I just said to you? Can you believe this? Can you believe this story, what I just told to you? So the next time you see one of the self-righteous people driving around in a hybrid, sneering at you and cutting you off in the right lane, which they all do. I don't know what it is. Like, guys who are short have to start bar fights and let their big friends finish them. I don't understand it, but everyone with a hybrid is speedy. They're all in zippy cars. You know who the zippy cars are? The ugliest car on the road is this Honda Box. It is the ugliest car ever made. It looks like a clown car. I don't need to wait for the circus to arrive. Every time I see a guy in one of those cars with an Obama sticker, I start to laugh hysterically. But they're always driving faster than anyone on the road from the right lane to prove to you that although they're little, they can drive as fast as you. And there's only one. I mean, if you're competitive as I am, it gets to you after a while. So I usually step on the gas and blow them away, and they get so mad if you're faster than them. They're driving every lane, cutting everyone off. You step on the gas and zoom away from them, and they can't quite get in front of you in the left lane, and they go crazy here in the San Francisco area. They put their lights on. That's the liberal thing. They put the lights on, and they shake their head from left to right. No, 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 like they're affecting you. What's the lights on? I almost got killed when I did that in New York a long time ago. Did I ever tell you that story? It's not in the book. They don't understand reality, liberals. I'm not a violent man. I just laugh at them. But there are people who are crazy. They will kill you for simply cutting them off. They'll kill you just for flashing your lights at them. This is an amazing story that I'm glad isn't in the book. I had moved back to New York in the mid-'80s. I had to leave California. So I had forgotten the mores of a dangerous city. The naked city can strip you bare fast. San Francisco may be violent, but it's in certain pockets of the city. New York can be dangerous anywhere at any time and can come at you like a bee out of nowhere. One night, not late, 9 o'clock, I'm on the service road of the Grand Central Parkway. I don't know what it was, and the guy stops in front of me for no reason. It was a dark portion of the service road somewhere in Queens. He was going slow, or he stopped. I flashed my lights. I didn't scream. I didn't yell. I didn't honk. I gave it one flash, like, what are you doing? Then I go to pass him on the right, and he blocks the car, and the windows go down, and two of the most murderous faces I've ever seen in my life looked at me, and they didn't say one word. They were deciding whether to kill me. And it looked like, you know, looking back on it, a guardian angel saved my life because I had my kid in the car, and frankly, he was young. And they probably figured it isn't worth it, not that they had any compassion for the kid, but they figured that they did. It looked to me like they just came from a murder, a butcher job somewhere. And I swear to God, I know afterwards, and it's happened to me a few times in my life where I've made an error. How did I know? What, a flash of a light is going to get you killed? And I learned something from that. The mere gesture in a car can get you killed. But the people in Marin County don't know that. The people in San Francisco don't know that. It's the, hey, hey, how, how, up yours, you're going to go. That's the crowd. Everyone is a, everyone they can give the finger to, because they've never been pushed in their life, let alone punched in the nose. No one's ever pushed them back. Now, this goes to their worldview. The liberal does not understand, never mind the highway, they don't understand the world. They don't understand what Iran is. They don't understand what Russia is. They don't understand what China is. They don't understand that the freedom they have has come to them from rivers of blood of American men who have bled to death all over the world so that they can go with the middle finger to you from the right lane. They don't understand that it was the infantrymen in World War II who froze in a foxhole in the Herson Forest, that it was the bomber pilot over Schweinfurt whose plane was shot down after he dropped bombs on a ball bearing plant, that has given them the freedom to give you the middle finger. And my friends, that is everything that's wrong with this crowd of juvenile morons at the Obama convention.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Obama will close the book on the old politics of race and gender and group against group and straight against gay.
I think the campaign brings together almost his life and his family's life story, which is civil rights, justice, health, and basically the well-being of the country. And I think the hopes in Barack that he has and the hopes for the country are exactly the hopes that he's always carried in his heart.
Yeah, yeah. These are just the... That's Heinz Kerry. Apparently she lost the... Was that Heinz Kerry? That didn't sound like the old Heinz Kerry, who was whose her cadence indicated something way off up in the higher reaches of the cerebrum. Play that for a minute, Clip. This is Teresa Heinz Kerry. It's not the old Heinz Kerry that I came to love. Let me hear this.
I think the campaign brings together...
Okay, no, no, it is her, but her voice is not what it once was. Do you have the old Heinz Kerry? Can you dig that? Because that was so precious, the old Teresa Heinz Kerry, John Kerry's wonderful ketchup wife. last year, a couple of years ago. I mean, we had plenty of fun with her. And when she spoke in Portuguese and French and Italian and wondered why the average person booed and whatever. Forget it. What am I talking about? You got the slip. Go ahead, play it.
He enjoys people from other countries. And if he would.
Wait. That's tonight. At the wrong. No, wait. Hold. Let's take a deep breath. Hold it. You got the piece. That's okay. I throw a lot of things at my guys at the last minute. I am playing John Kerry's wife a couple of years ago when she spoke in that very bizarre Manchurian candidate cadence that destroyed Kerry's campaign. Listen.
Tonight, as I have done throughout this campaign.
Bingo.
I would like to speak to you from the heart.
Okay, now I'm going to tell you something. That scared America. That was a psycho. Nobody wanted her to be Martha Washington. You got to understand what the First Lady is here. I'll tell you one thing Republicans are doing wrong. And I see that McCain, someone's listening to me because they followed my idea they should talk about his war record, which he's doing, get tough, which he's doing, attack, which he's doing. I can tell him a little bit more. Every time Cindy McCain appears, his numbers will go through the roof. People will react positively to a beautiful middle-aged woman. She has a grace about her. She doesn't project bimbo. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? You know, she's not a cougar out on the prowl for some young guy. She's a distinguished middle-aged woman who would be a glorious, gracious First Lady. And we want that right now. I'm sorry. We need it right now. We need some style in the White House. I'm not putting anyone down, but it's enough with the librarian and the horse and all of that. Remember the horse? We'll forget that. It's a little too understated right now. We don't want understated. We'd like elegance back in the White House. Now, let me tell you right now, Michelle Obama is a good-looking woman, but she's got meanness in her eyes, anger and hatred, and people are spooked by that. Their fear, you know, they get that. Cindy projects cheerleader, pom-pom, been through a lot, came out of it, still married to the same man, didn't run around on him, he didn't run around on her. They're a stable couple. She'd be a great First Lady. So if I have any advice to give to the McCain campaign, it would be let her speak. I noticed this. Every time she appears on the stage with John McCain, the devilish cameramen in the media will cut away from her, try to cut her out of the frame, or shoot from an angle where she can't be seen. You mark my words, I'm an expert at this. This is what I do for a living. They cut her out. They cut Cindy McCain out of the frame because she's too attractive. And she helps the McCain image. And that's all I want to say. Just show Cindy. That's all. How hard is that? I'll bet you she doesn't speak at the convention. I'll bet you $1 million they're not smart enough. It's going to be old white men in ugly suits with terrible ties that don't match. You know, I mean, that's what's coming next week. We know that. Bad ties, horse hair socks that they wear underneath their pants. I haven't worn them. I don't wear clothes like that. I don't know how someone could do that. Well, horrible. I pity people who have to wear a suit. I would have been dead 10 years ago if I had to wear a suit every day. I don't mind them. You look good. A man looks good in a suit. But it takes a toll on your body. I think it's worse than a hamburger. To have to wear a suit and tie every day, I think is worse than eating a hamburger and French fries. If you added up the stress level. Hey, did you read about the New York man who threw a $10,000 bar mitzvah for his dog? Yuck. You talk about an abomination of a religion. It doesn't get worse than this. Some New York guy threw a $10,000 bar mitzvah for his dog, Elvis. I got to tell you something. This could provoke anti-Semitism amongst Jews. It's so ugly. Can I hear the report, clip 18? Oh, my God. No.
It may look like your traditional bar mitzvah video, but this party is like no other. That's because the guest of honor is not a 13-year-old kid, but actually one very spoiled dog named Elvis.
Whatever it is, money is no object for Elvis.
David Best is Elvis's owner and says he's so proud of his pooch, he decided to throw him a bar mitzvah.
I think he's extremely handsome. He's got a great personality. Everybody loves Elvis. So I wanted to really show him off in that kind of setting.
100 guests were invited, including celebrities like Dr. Ruth and Patti LuPone. David even had a special surprise guest for Elvis.
The breeder from Connecticut brought his mother. We actually had a corsage for the mother.
Turn him off. This is an example of what happens when a religion has no meaning. This is what happens when a person is raised and not even understanding who God is or what religion is. This is what you call the mockery of his own religion. To me, this makes me sick. And how anybody can do this is beyond my imagination. I'm not telling him to be religious, but making a mockery of the beauty of a religion like this while being a co-religionist of the same religion, to me, is a disgrace. Senator Barbara Mikulski is speaking right now, so we'll go from one travesty to another. Go.
Every day of her career, the Supreme Court said there wasn't anything they could do. But there is something we can do about it. We can change the federal law book. We can put change in women's checkbooks. This November, we can't
get her off again. Women are not doing well in America, but she's sitting up there shooting her mouth off as a senator. Again, the women are oppressed in America. You hear this? How do you people take this garbage? It's right out of Animal Farm. This woman is directly out of the fable Animal Farm. Over 75 stories from Michael's colorful life history are contained in this limited first edition. I'd rather read my stories, I swear to God. Louie and his monkey, I did yesterday. Half man, half woman. The Nympho in Alley Pond Park. Happy and sad cufflinks. First autopsy. Talking to a bum about God. Let me hear Barbara Mikulski. I can handle it. Boxer now? Go, please.
Who have elected me 3 times to the United States Senate. I now chair the Environment and Public Works Committee.
When I took the power from the former
chairman, I told him this. I said, elections have consequences.
Yeah.
And when
no
we
kidding.
Win
Look
in
what
November,
you've done to the state.
We will prove it. Instead of protecting polluters, we'll protect our families.
Let's stop right here. Her and her husband, Stu, and her son have just decimated northern Marin County and left it for Oakland, California. The son is a lawyer. The husband's a lawyer. And she's a senator. It works hand in glove. And here's how it works. They wanted to convert some pristine land into an Indian gambling casino. So old Boxer got to work on the inside. And her family got to work on the outside. And then they worked the courts and they worked the system. And presto magico, a tribe no one ever heard of has a gambling casino on a once pristine land. Now, you wouldn't call that pollution, because after all, it's only a casino, and a casino doesn't pollute. Pollution is something that other people do outside of her backyard. Let's listen to the biggest hypocrite in the history of the United States government.
This
Go ahead.
November, we can't afford more of the same. So let's elect Barack Obama so that the world's economic and environmental
Get her off the stage. I can't wait. I hope to God to live long enough to see this woman retired. I hope I live long enough to see this mouth shut already. This woman gets me crazy to think that a yenta like her, who in my day would have been running a brassiere store on Union Turnpike, top two, if she had been in it 20 years and saved wisely, she would have expanded to 2 brassiere stores, one in Flushing and one in Jackson Heights, maybe top. And that's it. Now a U.S. senator with a big mouth, an expert on the environment, and never walked in the environment, so far as I know. So far as I know, has never been on a sailboat on San Francisco Bay, never hiked Marin County, but an expert on the environment. This is what you call utter hypocrisy of the lowest level, not the highest. She irks me badly. Now, perhaps she irks me because she went to a high school in Brooklyn, and I know exactly what she is. I know exactly what she stands for. I know exactly where she comes from. I know exactly where she goes. And it's not a far, 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 far better place that she goes than from what she came, I can guarantee you. I believe she will go to a far worse place from where she came. I'll be right back. Savage.
I think you can tell the comfort a man has with women and whether or not he gets it or not by the women, if the women around him are strong.
That's the brilliant sage Joe Biden, reinvented as a sagacious new American, someone who's been around for 3,000 years in the Senate and is being positioned as someone who represents change. He suddenly likes a strong woman. Then why did they throw Hillary under the bus? Democrats like strong women. Oh, really? They took Hillary Clinton and threw her overboard pretty quick. But look, it's all politics. I don't really have, what do I care? The only thing I care about is, truthfully, America's survival and my survival and my family. Well, what do you think I really care about? I mean, you think about it's all self-interest. I don't trust Barack Obama. I don't trust his politics. I don't trust his wife. I don't trust the people around him. Do I like McCain? I don't know him, but I trust him more. Period, end of story. Is McCain going to grant amnesty to illegals? Sure. Do I like that? No, I despise it. Can I do anything about it? No. The powers that be are so strong. The businesses so badly want cheap labor. The government so badly wants live bodies to justify their budgets that I'm afraid it's hopeless on that regard. It's terrible. It's heartbreaking to say. The only hope for this is a story I told a long time ago, which was my time in Kentucky Fried Chicken on a Sunday morning. When I went in there, I was eating a Kentucky Fried Chicken a year or so ago on a regular basis. Then I stopped. Their chicken is unbelievable. And every Sunday I would see well-dressed Hispanic men and women with their little daughters and boys and beautiful little, you know, whatever they had, cheap clothing that was clean that went for the church. And the father held a daughter. Remember I told you that story? He kissed his daughter, the little girl. In a way, I hadn't seen a man kiss his little girl since when I was a kid, and immigrant fathers were not afraid to kiss their children in public. Today, a man's afraid to kiss his own children. They're afraid that they'll, it's like the ex-Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. They can call Child Protective Service. They can lose the child. Daddy kissed me on the cheek, and my cheek is wet. Oh, get the mean face clip dad brigade. Oh, get the fire engines. Arrest daddy. They've destroyed the family. They destroyed everything, these people. So what I'm saying is you go to a place like KFC and you see these families, say maybe that's the hope for America. They don't even know what's going on outside them with regard to the social policies of this country. And they care less, too. I said, that's the only hope. And I'm the kind of guy, if I'm around, you know, I'll survive whatever it is. You give me a donkey, I ride a donkey. They take away everything I own, I'll start again and I'll still win. That's how I feel. I don't care. At any age, I'll still win. They took away my birthright with affirmative action, and guess what? I beat them all. So that's it. I'm not afraid of them. I'll do what I have to do. That's the world I live in. And you know, this is going to make me drift into another topic. You have to understand people who came from the ex-Soviet bloc and how they see the world. Although I don't come from the ex-Soviet bloc, I understand people who do, and I understand how they see the world. And many of them, the poorer ones, con the system. They get medical care they're not entitled to. They'll work the system till doctors hate their guts. I mean, I know doctors who have Russian patients who cannot stand what they do to the doctor. They can't stand how they milk the system for every penny it's worth. I mean, here's people who came from the ex-Soviet Union 20 years ago. They never had zilch over there. And here they demand things that they never, the leaders of the Soviet Union couldn't have gotten. And these people will take this country for every dime they can get out of it. And they hate them for it. You ask the doctors, they hate them for it. Then I will tell you something else. You get the wealthier people from ex-Soviet Union. They have a totally cynical, jaundiced view of government, as do I, by the way. And this is interesting. I have almost the same view of government as do ex-Soviets. And it's strange, I was born here. But I have the same distrust of authority. I have the same contempt for authority, by the way. And I have the same contempt for government that they do, by what I've seen, how government works. And the fact of the matter is, that is a product of the world that they lived in. The only way they were able to survive in the ex-Soviet Union was by sneering at the bureaucrat, getting around the bureaucrat, cheating the bureaucrat, and basically could care less about him. And they learned how to survive with that attitude. And why that's happening in America on an increasing basis is because we have become increasingly socialist in America. The government has become overly large, especially under George Bush. And anything that becomes overly large becomes impersonal, indifferent, and frankly, monolithic to the point that it's inhuman. And it dehumanizes you when you get near it, whether you go for a license at the DMV or go for medical care at an emergency room. By and large, the American people have become, in essence, conditioned for a Soviet-style government, and we're more than 50% there. The question is, who will bring it about faster, Obama or McCain? In my opinion, clearly Obama is on that track. When I come back, stories from the radio to break up the fair right here on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Disproportionately, it singles out poor people to pay the ultimate punishment for their crime. We all know this. 95% plus of people on death row are poor. Death is almost exclusively punishment for poor people. Or as they say on the streets, capital punishments means. Then without the capital, get the punishment. We know this.
Now, that's a nutty woman, in this case a nun, who was speaking off campus, as it were, at the Democrat convention. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. Thinking of a nutty woman, I've met quite a few in my life, and that's not misogynistic. It's unfortunately true for me. I don't know about you. I met a lot of nutty guys, too, but in this case, I met a lot of nutty women. And this woman provokes memories that I'd rather forget. And one of the nuttiest women I ever met in my life was in my childhood, and she was the mother of my best friend at the time. I haven't seen him in years. He turned out crazier than her. I don't blame him for it, with a mother like that. And I put that story, my friend had a nutty mother, I don't know exactly the title, somewhere in the book. Here, nutty friend had crazy mother. It follows Fat Al's tuna and Coney Island wax figures in my new autobiography, Psychological Nudity, which you can buy at michaelsavage.com. Please listen to the story. I had a nutty friend, a real SOB, a piece of garbage. He was a miserable rat, even as a kid a miserable rat, because he had a crazy mother who was on Benzedrine to lose weight. She went to some crazy doctor in Jersey who put her on speed. She'd come back nuts. I mean, crazy. And she'd drive the pink Cadillac. They had a little more money than everyone else. The father was hardworking. She was a nothing. Always on Benzedrine and a wacko. She was so crazy that she would take a dog chain. She once did this and beat herself across the wrists and they were bleeding. So when the husband came home at night, like from working all day from some delivery route that he owned, he had a franchise, whatever. She came screaming. She said, Joe, look what your son did to me. Look what he did to me. And the father would go upstairs and he had a fist fight with the son because the crazy mother said that the son did this to her wrist when she did it herself. Can you believe this kind of situation? So I have no compassion for him. He was a rat before that. And he's still a rat. He's still a no good Nick. But he was a good friend of mine when I was in the fifth grade, because who knows? You don't know people. And since I was sort of a mischievous child, naturally I sought out the more mischievous of the students, those who fidgeted the most, had the brightest eyes, and never listened to the teacher. They were my kind of people. Today already they put us into Ritalin therapy and turn us into robots. I wouldn't be on the radio today. I'd be like an accountant somewhere in a prison. I'd be counting underwear for a prison somewhere to make sure that the underwear didn't get stolen. But the long and short was, yeah, the crazy mother. That doesn't excuse him for being nuts. As years went on, one of the kids in the neighborhood became a very famous, two of them became famous rock and roll singers, two, out of Queens. I won't mention their names. One had a big hit at 11 or 13 years old. He was always more mature than us. He had, like, women. You know, like guys at 13, like the guys with a pompadour, and he had, like, a girlfriend 19. I never understood that. We were still, like, dreaming. This guy had, like, a woman. You know, she was 20. I don't know how they got that, like, through the music business. They probably gave him a... So he went and did a tour, this musician, in Japan at 14, dropped out of high school. He had one song. It was a huge hit, like 145. I don't remember. It wasn't Run Around Sue, but it was in that genre. So he goes to Japan, a big tour. The Japanese always liked American rock and rollers. Now he comes back. Now it's years later. Now he's on his behind. And he's got nothing. So he becomes a U.S. postman. I swear to God, years later, the same rock and roller who had the Jaguar before anyone could even drive, the blue Jaguar, the cuff that stood out of the jacket, the pompadour, became a postman. There's nothing wrong with being a postman, but, you know, you start out as a rock and roller and you end up as a postman. That's a pretty hard row, you know what I'm saying? It's better to start out as a postman and end up as a rock and roll star, let me tell you. What'd you say I was going to talk about before I told that story? He had a blue Jaguar, an XK-140 MC drophead coupe, To this day, I want that car. I have a Ferrari. I still want that 56 XK140 drophead coupe. So that bad kid, going back now to the bad kid whose mother beat herself on the arm. So we like to go around all over New York by subway, and we were like 12, 13. We went everywhere. 12, 13, 14, Manhattan, Hubert's Flea Circus, down in the bowels of the basement of the subways, there were guys selling, like, they weren't porno magazines. They were soft core. And the old, you see the old geezers there lining up looking at the magazines. We try to, like, you look at them. Hey, kid, get out of here. Get out of here, kid. Get out of here. You know, that kind of thing. So we used to like to go to Coney Island, and they had exhibits. I don't know how to describe it. They were like mannequins of wax figures. And there were some of them were scary as heck. Well, one of them was of George Metetsky, the mad bomber of the subway. And it was so lifelike. Like, if you were a kid 12 and you had just been on a New York subway car in the heat for an hour and you went out to Coney Island and you stood outside one of those exhibits and you looked in, they showed him like in a jail cell. The guy looked like he was going to come out of the cell and strangle you. Well, adjacent to that mad bomber display, there was another guy. This scared me to this day. I have nightmares about him. It showed a guy, I don't know what he did, dismembered girls or women. I don't remember what he did. He was really bad, this one. And he looked like ordinary Joe, white guy, ordinary guy. And they found him. I remember it was like a mad thing in New York. They didn't know what to do. Girls were being found dismembered. Finally, they tracked this nut down to a chicken farm in New Jersey. I don't remember his name. And he's got like a corpse in a trunk under the bed. I mean, the whole thing, man. So this exhibit in Coney Island of the wax figure shows this guy reconstructed in wax in a little room in the back of a chicken farm with a dismembered girl's body in a trunk. And he's got like blood on his feet with like a blank stare at you. And they show you like the feet and the hands and the blood. It was stuff that today they could never, ever show you. But life was richer as a result. For example, they had freak shows in those days. A genuine freak show is not so bad. The freak had a job. If I went to Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey, I didn't go for the horse. Oh, the elephant. I went for the freak show in the back. The one-breasted man. The half-bearded woman. The microcephalic. In other words, the people who today became politicians, in my day, they were in the back room of Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey without a Windsor nut. Or in another display, the same people today you might find on CNN or ABC or CBS, you know, after some surgery, they were in the freak show too. You know, half man, half woman, half human, half amoeba. And it was wonderful. I like the whole thing. You eat the popcorn, you walk around, you gape at the freak, you thank God that you're not like them. But the truth of the matter is, you say, well, it's exploited with the freak. No, if you ask freaks, I didn't know how to call them that today. You ask somebody, a freak of nature like that, they liked being in a freak show. They made a good living. They were around other abnormal people. They had a little, you know, world, a social world. They had sex, some of them, with each other. They socialize. Today, what? They sit at home watching television on welfare? You think that's better for a freak? No. So there's something to be said for going back to the America of the 1950s. Please don't bring up the Civil Rights Act. Do me a favor. I mean, America of the 1950s with a Civil Rights Act. Can we move on now? It was a better country. Okay, everyone's equal, but give me back the freak show. And give me back the exhibit of the guy that a kid could see there with a nut. Because, you know, why should a kid see that? A kid should see that to understand there are dangers in the world. Certain people are really crazy and bad. Get it? That's it. That was, what a chain of events that is. That is, what do you call that, free associational. And these stories are all broken up into psychological nudity. My new book, which I'm very, very happy with. I think it starts here. Yeah, here it is. Nutty Friend Had Crazy Mother, followed by Coney Island Wax Figures, Dead Man's Pants, Tippy the Mad Dog, and Woodchuck Bill. Plus, Louie and His Crazy Monkey, Half Man, Half Woman, The Yawn Man Gets Brain Cancer. That's sad. The Nympho in Alley Pond Park, Fiji Islands, 1969, Happy and Sad Cufflinks, First Autopsy, that's a beauty, Working on Cruise Lines, Talking to a Bum About God, Love by the Sewer Plant, Mama Savage Calls, and From Immigrant Son to Radio Stardom, and many more favorites. Savage will grip you with insightful political commentaries that include, and these are the politicals, what if John McCain's middle name was Jesus? That's a good story, and that's why I put that in. A little politics never hurt, particularly in a political season. And I have to reiterate why I did that. Barack Hussein Obama. You're not allowed to say Hussein. Why? Why can't we ask, what does that name signify? And I said, if John McCain had a middle name named Jesus, I guarantee you that the libs are saying, oh, John McCain's middle name is Jesus. What does that mean? They wouldn't have stopped with that one. It is a must for everyone who's read a Savage book, an original classic of America's storyteller. Go to michaelsavage.com right now. And you got to admit that Teddy looks great with his little Hawaiian outfit. That was actually at a birthday party 2 years ago that the photographer, Adam, was looking down from the balcony of this house down onto the patio where I was holding the dog. And we looked up. He said, look up. And bingo. I mean, tell you the truth, Teddy is so much. Okay, I have sunglasses on, so you can't see my eyes. It's a hot day. But you look in Teddy's eyes, he's a seeing soul dog. Teddy is my seeing soul dog. You can look right into his eyes. I don't know how to put it. It's an angel with fur. I mean, this guy is going to have some career. Already, I think the offers are flowing in. He's got an agent. I don't even have an agent. My dog does. Charlie in Utah, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mike, how you doing? This is Charlie from Richmond Hill, Queens.
How you doing? But you're in Utah? What are you doing in Utah?
I live here. They like me here. Yeah, I'm in New York. This place, New Yorker.
Hey, in other words, with that accent in Utah, you're running by a pizzeria there? Or,
No. Hey, you used to go to the Valencia Theater. You used to go there and pick up girls.
I remember the Valencia. Didn't it have stars on the ceiling, and it was set up like a planetarium? It was gorgeous.
Yeah, it was beautiful. You take your girl.
That was before the city turned into a toilet bowl.
Yes.
Of course, it's come back today, but no, that was a great. You picked up girls in a movie theater. How did you see them in the dark?
Oh, hey! I'm a trained observer. I'm in New York.
Yeah. I don't know how you could pick up a girl in a movie theater. I mean, you couldn't see anybody. Are you sure you picked up girls?
Oh, yes. She said to me, listen, I'm sorry, I got a bad cold. I thought I'd swallowed a chewing gum, you know?
I know that's getting edited. That's not so bad. Hey, but, Charlie, let me ask you something. How is witness protection in Utah?
I don't know. Fortunately, I'm not involved in that.
No, you're going to tell me you are. Of course not. So, Charlie, what do you think of the Democrat National Convention thus far?
I don't even bother with it. I don't even bother with it. You know, Mike, it's a disgrace. You know, all phony.
Well, it's a show, and it's a bad show, and what's the point of watching it? And you know, Charlie, honest to God, this is why I'm working my stories in and out of today's show and all this week, because you can't do this convention day and night. It's impossible. Am I right about that?
Yeah. McCain used to be on my old ship. I remember McCain.
What ship was that? Wait a minute. Hold on. Don't tell me. You don't mean the ship where he had that accident, do you?
No, he was on the Oriskany when they had a missile backfire, and they almost lost a lot of sailors.
Were you on the Oriskany?
No, I was on the other ships. He was on one of my ships, the Intrepid.
Now, wasn't he a Marine? He was a Marine aviator, wasn't he?
No. He was a Navy officer, Navy pilot.
Okay, yeah, I understand. He's a naval aviator, but he was. I thought the guys who fly the jets on carriers are in the U.S. Marines.
No, well, you got a combination of them, you know. You get most of it's Navy pilots, and then you got Marines on the amphibs, you know, for the close in attack stuff. But
well, I was on that carrier 2 years ago, I tell you, it was the greatest in many ways of my whole life. That experience, we went out on one of the great modern carriers for one night. They didn't helicopter us out. They took us out by tailhook, which unto itself is amazing to be arrested. Like, you know, that plane is arrested on the landing. But I'll tell you the truth, Charlie, to this day, as a visitor, they put you on a plane and jettison you off the carrier deck. I could not believe the sensation, because he said, get ready for it. You're shot out by that steam thing. It's, I don't know, for like 20 seconds, you feel like you're floating in space. There's a sense of timelessness and spacelessness as the plane is shot off the deck of the carrier. That's something I will never, ever forget.
Oh, yeah. That'll take care of your prostate.
No, I don't have a problem with that. Hey, thanks for the call. I'm a lucky guy. I'm very lucky when you consider the. You know, I've been riding a bicycle, and I provoked another idea here. I've been riding a bicycle all my life. And I mean, since I'm an adult, all my adult life, almost every day that I could. And I don't, thank God, don't have any prostate problems. You want to hear why? This is an interesting story, and maybe it'll help you. 35 years ago or so, Mrs. S. found a split seat in an airline magazine for fat men. I wasn't fat. I weighed very little. I was like lean, running. But it was said to be like it, two seats, in other words, that both rotated on their own coupling so that the middle part of the man's body did not touch the seat. And consequently, I mean, I've been very, very fortunate because, you know, bicycle seats are not what God had intended when he designed the male. That's all I can tell you. That story is not in volume one. I'll save that one for volume two. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Why is John Edwards not up on the stage? I mean, the guy was almost president and vice president. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. Wife blasted for keeping Edwards' affair secret, Associated Press. 2 weeks after a devastating revelation sent her husband in political exile, Elizabeth Edwards isn't getting the steady sympathy usually afforded to a woman scorned, is the article. Well written. It's on michaelsavage.com from AP. I've noticed AP has gotten very balanced lately. There's a horrible story on my website from the local San Francisco newspaper. It came out that certain judges, not all, are actually protecting drug dealers in San Francisco. They're drug dealers who are 14 years old, but they're drug dealers. And this is presenting a problem for the federal government that I think the federal government's going to have to deal with. Judges are protecting drug dealers in San Francisco. They're using 14-year-old runners to sell crack, and the judges are actually protecting the drug dealers in this city. That's all up on michaelsavage.com with other great stories. Carville, even Carville, the human lizard, says this convention has no message. Carville, the human lizard, half man, half lizard, from the panhandle of Florida. Jewish Democrat delegates walk out on Jimmy Carter. Bet that didn't make it to CNN. Did you know the Jewish Democrat delegates walked out on Jimmy Carter and went boo, boo, boo? You didn't know about that. Didn't make it to your local newspaper either. Political plankton walked the plank. The transformation of Michelle Obama from michaelsavage.com is now up on my website, as are many other stories that we have touched on or we will touch on the Savage Nation. Daniel Pipes wrote Barack Obama Through Muslim Eyes. Great article. Don't miss it. Go to michaelsavage.com. New York City, WOR. Sal, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Oh, Michael, I agree with you just about mostly all of the time, but you hit a nerve when you said Teddy was the best-looking dog in the world. I got the best one. His name is...
what is your dog?
He's a corgi. I've had him for 10 years. And
Corgis the guys with the little feet?
Yeah, he got short legs. They're basically like a German Shepherd, but they have short legs. He's not that big.
But Sal, when you walk around with a corgi in New York, doesn't his belly scrape against the dirty streets?
No. Actually, I'm in Connecticut, Waterbury, Connecticut. I listen.
You listen to me on WOR because you say, "How could you have a corgi in Manhattan?" I can't understand that. I figured, but okay, Connecticut's another story.
Right. But he is.
Isn't a corgi bred to chase animals down holes?
Oh yeah, they were bred to hurt. And when I first got him...
What do you mean herd? With little feet?
They used them to herd sheep and cattle. And,
but why would a corgi with little feet be used to herd sheep? I thought that the little feet and the big body were to enable... The breeding was to enable the dog to get into small, you know, burrows.
Oh, no. What they did is that they nipped the ankles and... I had to break them out.
They made little feet, the farmers. They kept breeding the dogs with little feet.
Right.
They nipped the ankles, not bite him in the Achilles heel.
Right. He used to nip everybody, even my daughter's ankles. He'd go down the hall, he'd be nipping them.
But why do you love the dog the most?
Michael, pardon me?
Why do you love him the most? I mean, what do you love about the dog?
I love him. No matter how I feel... The bad mood I am, all this junk going on with the convention. I don't want to listen to that.
I know, the convention. That's why we're talking about dogs now. I mean, who can take it? You got all those dogs up on the stage there. I mean, hey, thanks for the call. We all love our pets. Why not? Look, there's an advantage to a pet as opposed to a grandchild. A pet cannot become a junkie. That's number one. No inheritance, number two. And frankly, there's no way for the dog to become a pervert. They're a beat. They beat everything.
Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. We are looking with astonishment at the Democrat convention, which basically is a big blah. It's nothing. There's nothing there. They're saying nothing. They're playing it vanilla. And so we're also intercutting my celebration and hopefully your joy at the publication of my new book, Psychological Nudity, which contains all of the stories you've heard on the radio and then some, 75 stories. And the book has not even been printed yet. It's been written and it's being typeset as I speak. The cover is on michaelsavage.com. Now, I have a story for you right now that you're going to actually shake your head and say this can't be true. Headline, San Francisco to pay family of man who fell from Nob Hill roof. But that's not the story. A heroic fireman tried to rescue a suicidal nut. The guy was sitting on a roof without his shoes on, threatening to kill himself. This fireman goes out on a limb, almost dies. The guy falls off the roof. The family sues the fire department, and the city agrees to settle with the nuts family. I cannot believe this. I can't understand how anybody could be a fireman or a cop in this world with these vultures called lawyers. I have no idea how anybody can do anything. And the day is going to come. Well, I'll stop right here. I'll stop right here because I have had it. And I've had it with tort lawyers that you can't believe. They're vermin. They're vultures. They're the lowest scum on the planet. An attorney for the family of the nut filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city after the fireman tried to save him. A spokesman for the city attorney's office declined to comment on details of the proposed settlement, including the amount, until city officials decide whether to approve it. Now listen to this. The attorney, Michael Meadows, says, the law is extremely protective of any rescue personnel. They have various immunities that make cases against them based on negligence, almost impossible. On the other hand, this was clearly a botched rescue. Things should have been done differently. That's this verminous. I only hope the lawyer doesn't fall off a roof. I only hope this lawyer, Michael Meadows, does not need a fireman to rescue him or his family member ever in his life, because I can guarantee you they'll go out to lunch. They'll go out for a hydration break. Remember the name, attorney Michael Meadows, called it a botched rescue. The guy died in October of 06 after falling four stories from the roof of an apartment building. He fell after the fireman tried to grab him from behind as he sat on the edge of the roof. Can you believe this? The city medical examiner was unable to determine whether the death was an accident or suicide. What a medical examiner. Dr. Judy Malinick, assistant medical examiner. She wrote in a conclusion that the stiff's acts that day, including removing his shoes and climbing up the building's outdoor fire escape, quote, appeared organized and intentionally self-destructive in nature, but she couldn't determine whether it was an accident or suicide, so the city gets sued. The fireman, who risked his life and almost fell off the roof, is now sitting there saying, what did I do wrong? In their lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in San Francisco, which is a mockery unto itself, there is no U.S. District Court in San Francisco. It's run by a bunch of left-wing fanatics who hate police, firemen, and talk show hosts. Bonnie and Carlos Tirico, the parents of the nut, in my opinion, said that the fireman's actions played a significant role in their son's death. The lawsuit, which alleges civil rights violations, how could his civil rights have been violated? aren't you liberals ashamed of yourself that you would let scum, verminous lawyers use a civil rights action against a fireman who risked his life in this lawsuit? In an interview after the lawsuit, the father, Carlos Tirico, said, "There are many issues involved. I think accountability is the critical part from our perspective," close quote. Well, you know, Mr. Tirico, I'm sorry that your son died and fell off the roof, but you really ought to look in a mirror. And I only hope you spend the money on a doctor. I hope the money that you steal from this city, in my opinion, and the shame you are bringing upon the fireman who risked his life to save your sick son, I only hope you spend it on doctors. The lawyer for the nut said that, "I think everyone understands the severity of the loss of the parents. They weren't particularly interested in money. And all of this made it easy to resolve it. They weren't interested in money." Oh, I love that. Don't you love it? None of them really want money, the people who sue. They do it for the principle. The principle. Well, you know, my heart goes out to the firemen. That's all I can say. I'm just shocked that the fire department would approve this. Who would go into the work of being a fireman or a cop today with these vultures out there who, as I say, I only hope these vultures never fall off a roof. I only hope the lawyers listening to this show never need a fireman to risk their life for them or their family members. That's all I can say. And now on to something nicer, which is, you know, a story. I feel like angry now. Now I'm getting angry, and I don't like getting angry. I hate getting angry. I decided I don't want to get angry because a guy, 63, died yesterday swimming from Angel Island, from Alcatraz to the city. A dentist, perfect shape. He's practicing for triathlon event. And he's swimming with his son-in-law, and he's resting along the way, and boom, his heart blows out. Dead. Good shape, no heart problems, and gone. See, you got to understand you can't push a certain body after a certain age. I see a lot of men running, bicycling. They're gray, and they're in good shape, apparently. But you know what's wrong with them? They need to go home and have a couple of drinks and a good meal and put on some weight. I think a lot of men are obsessed with being thin when thinness is not the norm for a man over a certain age. You shouldn't be thin. It's a mark of illness. You should put on some weight, have a few drinks, and eat a little red meat once in a while. You'll probably live an extra 5 years. That's been my opinion. I've tell you the data supports it, too, and I can tell you all about it, that this obsession with low cholesterol, this obsession with being thin, is what's killing a lot of men young. I'm not saying get fat. I didn't say become a drunk and get fat. Don't get me wrong. But I see these guys panting and this and that, and that's the kind of guy I am. That's why I say psychological nudity. Oh, I got to tell you something. Would you please go on michaelsavage.com and see, click here to see the contents. You must see the inside flap with the picture of the x-ray of my brain. Come on. You got to admit nobody in the history of publishing has ever done this. Click here to see the back cover. Here. On the second, first edition printing of Classic American Tales from the Phenomenal Life of Dr. Michael Savage. But on the left, since it's called psychological nudity, it's creative. I took one cross section of my brain from the CAT scan that was done on me 2 weeks ago in the emergency room, and I put the picture. What's amazing to me is the sagittal section of my brain, a face comes out like a smiley face with eyes and nose and a mouth. I don't know how this works. The pieces of the brain, there's no tumor in there. Everything's fine. The liberals were wrong. They thought they'd find a devil when they did a CAT scan of my brain. There were no devils inside my head, I am proud to say. In a minute, we're going to go to a wonderful break. And after the break, we're going to go to an interview I did earlier about a banned book about Aisha, the wife, I think it's the young wife of Muhammad. We have the author, Asra Nomani, who I spoke with. We are already living in the Soviet Union because Random House pulled the book for fear of objecting Muslims who now suddenly want to impose their wonderful, wonderful freedom-loving worldview upon America. And so, consequently, the cowardly Random House owned by Bertelsmann pulled the book, even though it was ready to be published. That's why I self-published Psychological Nudity. No publishers, no editing, no censorship. There it is. Don't you understand that I have bypassed the entire censorship world with the new internet that I am using? God bless America. God bless the internet. And believe me, I don't like censorship of any kind. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage.
By now, you've probably heard about a novel about to be published that was pulled about Aisha, the young wife of Muhammad. Anyway, Random House pulled it because they feared that by insulting Muslims, they would make it the new satanic verses and they'd be threatened. Our next guest, Asra Nomani, reported on it for the Wall Street Journal and has insights into this story that most reporters do not have. Asra Nomani, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on today, even though I probably will end up getting a fatwa because I'm on your show.
Give us some background on your article.
Yeah, what we've got unfolding right now in the publishing industry and in the conversation between the Muslim world and the West is the sort of the next chapter on the debate set off by the satanic verses. There's a journalist in Spokane, Washington, who has been working the last several years on a novel about Aisha, the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad. And so Random House bought the novel from her last year in a $100,000 two-book deal. She was thrilled. It was the realization of all her dreams. It was going to be her first novel. I've got the book right here in front of me, and you know, the back of the novel says there's going to be a publicity tour of 8 cities, and the book was set to be released on August 12th. But the spring, when Random House was sending galleys around to different folks trying to get blurbs, like they typically do for new releases, they sent one to a professor of Islamic history at the University of Texas at Austin by the name of Denise Spellberg. She'd written a book herself on Aisha, an academic book put out by Columbia Press, and lo and behold, she didn't like the book. She thought that it was insulting and offensive and, you know, took issue with some of the creative license that the novelist Sherry Jones had written into her novel. She reached out to her editor, who happens to be at a Random House imprint on a new book that she's doing on Thomas Jefferson's Quran. And within a day, her protests had circulated all through Random House, and her editor related that Denise had thought that the book would be a declaration of war with the Muslim world and a national security issue. And within a day, Random House decided that they would possibly postpone publication of the book. And then 3 weeks later, they had decided that they would definitely postpone publication, and by the next month, earlier this summer, they had a termination agreement. So they basically decided that they were not going to take the risk.
Well, what caused this to get out of hand so quickly?
Well, you know, I spent the entire summer reading this novel. I wasn't going to write about it unless I felt like I could actually support it as a piece of writing that could actually contribute something to our world. You know, read The Red Tent, read Da Vinci Code, have heard all of the protests about the creative license with the stories regarding Mary Magdalene and Jesus. And I'm old school journalist. I've always read nonfiction, mostly appreciated it, but have increasingly believed that historical fiction has a real value, especially when we can't understand a faith like Islam isn't understood. There's parts of the book that are definitely going to be offensive because the book basically goes into the bedroom of the Prophet Muhammad and into the private space that he had with his wives. The novelist calls it a harem. Some historians, you know, take issue with that characterization. But nonetheless, I mean, there were a lot of chicks under one roof. And as anybody would expect, there was a lot of issues of jealousy and intrigue, plotting and conniving. It's chronicled in the traditions and the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. It's part of the historical record.
Mm-hmm.
The novelist, you know, goes into the night when the Prophet consummates his marriage to Aisha and, you know, goes through basically his own temptations and lustful relationships with women. It's not the kind of stuff that some folks want to know about somebody that they revere as a prophet. But you know, like any good novel, it's a tale ultimately of redemption and reconciliation. And so what we really get is this journey of Aisha from a little girl, which she historically was when she was engaged to the prophet, and her emergence as a strong, fierce woman. And that's a story worth telling, I think, because so often in all of this diatribe about the Muslim world, we forget that, in fact, the women at the birth of Islam were very fierce and had pretty strong status, even better than perhaps today in a lot of communities. you know, how did it snowball? This is my issue, is that fear ultimately allowed Random House to just buckle under the threat of violence by Muslims. There was hardly a peep that they heard from any Muslims. They didn't hear about any protests until after they'd already made their decisions. You know, quietly, Dr. Spellberg had talked to another Muslim that she knew, and word got out on a website. But really, in this case, interestingly, what I wrote was that the instigator wasn't some radical cleric in a village in Pakistan, but a professor of history in Texas.
Well, what happens to the book now? What's next?
The book's going to get published. The author's gotten several offers from big publishing houses. The book already is under contract to be published in Spain. And what I believe is that we don't have to be the caricatures that we often can be in the Muslim world. We don't have to become that scary image that everybody thinks that we are. We can be intelligent. We can have a smart discourse. There's going to be folks screaming and yelling on all sides. Your radio program is notorious for being provocative. That's part of conversation. I don't think that's the best part of a conversation, but it's going to happen, and it's going to happen on all sides. For all of the people who are blasting Random House for this decision, they're going after the Muslims who hardly even had a peep in this debate because, hey, it's easy to do that. And come on, those Muslims, they get all crazy and wild anyway, so it's not that much of a gamble to expect that they would. But as an American Muslim who has been grounded in this country and then in my Islamic tradition with a real concept of civilized discourse, I really believe we can do it. And we have to barrel through. We have to take the heat when it is, you know, moments like this, when there's moments of offense or a slight, and just rise above it. I know people have their backs up against the wall, but I really don't think that we have to be defined by the lowest common denominator in society.
Well, that's an important point. Can you stay with us through the break so we can hear more about your thoughts on this?
Sure.
Savage.
Back speaking with Astra Nomani about the censored novel about Muhammad's young wife, Aisha. So, Astra, tell us a little about yourself, your background.
I was born in India into a conservative Muslim family, became a journalist in my 20s, and didn't write a word about Islam while I was reporting at the Wall Street Journal for some 15 years. I was on the fence. Like a lot of Muslims, I saw increasing conservatism in my community. I saw the importation of puritanical Wahhabi ideology into my hometown of Morgantown, West Virginia. But I stayed quiet, and I had my wake-up call after September 11th, like a lot of people. I went to Pakistan to report. I got a house there. I'd fallen in love, and one of my first visitors was my dear friend Danny Pearl from the Wall Street Journal and his wife, Marianne. They came for an interview that Danny was going to do. He went off for that interview on January 23rd, 2002, and the rest is history. He never returned. We spent a month trying to find Danny.
Oh, my God.
And in that month, I faced off against the darkest expression of Islam in our world today. I, you know, basically heard the stories of how the emails and images of Danny and captivity had been passed off by couriers at a mosque in Karachi. I felt really angry. I came back from Karachi really incensed. I had the kind of rage that I think a lot of Americans and perhaps many of your listeners have felt, you know, when they have seen violence perpetuated in the name of this religion.
We've all felt that rage.
I came back, and I was really, really hating my own faith. And I had the good fortune then to have another opportunity to kind of dive back into my religion by going into the birthplace of Islam in Saudi Arabia on the pilgrimage to Mecca. And trust me, it took everything, every bit of my willpower not to just hate every moment of that trip, because to me, Saudi Arabia, represents the worst practice of Islam in the world. I had to be afraid, that a strand of my hair might peek out for fear of punishment, and had to always make sure that my father was around as my male chaperone. And on top of it, I went as an unwed mother, a single mom without a wedding ring. I had discovered that I was pregnant in the midst of trying to find Danny. My boyfriend was a Muslim man who bailed on me. And you know, we're in our Muslim world where America was the time of the Scarlet Letter. And so I was afraid, but I also then decided to really try to dive into the history of Islam. And there, walking in the footsteps of Hajar, the concubine or second wife of Abraham, I actually felt the pulse of a type of Islam that I didn't feel alive today, one in which a single mother ran between two hills trying to find water for her son, a place where the prophet's first wife was his boss. And, I, as a woman, though, in the 21st century, couldn't run in Hajar's footsteps because the Saudi prayer book told me that I could only walk briskly, perhaps, because it would be too titillating for a man to otherwise see women running. And so I came back to America really inspired to stand off against this ideology that tried to basically disempower me. I went back to Morgantown, found out that our mosque was opening. Just was really excited because it was going to be bigger and better. But my first day, I got my rude wake-up call. And one of the elders stood at the front door and said, "Sister, take the back door." I was to be relegated to the back door and a balcony along with the rest of the other women without voice, without ability to participate. And what I discovered as a writer and as a just member of my community is that we are just so stunted in our ability right now to have honest conversations. They're not always going to be pretty. They're oftentimes going to be ugly, but we have to have these conversations.
Did you ask any of these national Muslim organizations to help you?
You know, one of your favorite folks, the Council on American Islamic Relations, has an important mandate to stand up for Muslims in America. But when I called them to help have them help me stand up for my rights as an American Muslim woman in my mosque against this ideology that was subordinating me, they wouldn't get involved because they weren't going to dive into this thorny world of Islamic-Islamic relations.
So what happened in your mosque? What changes were made?
Well, the men were very clear that they didn't want women in the main hall. And my father, a man in his 60s who considers himself a feminist, went with me and my mother, my niece, my nephew, and my young boy into the main hall one morning. They surrounded us and told us to leave. And my father has lost all of his friends in the struggle, has been alienated from inside the community. But we won institutional change. Women are allowed into that main hall now. The American Muslim community has understood very clearly that we can't put women in second-class status in our places of worship. CARE, along with all of the other Muslim organizations, ultimately signed on, at least in on paper, to a policy in which they defend the right of women to be in the main halls and to participate face-to-face in mosque leadership. But, you know, women in my mosque are to this day intimidated and afraid by the status quo from going into the main hall. Women are nonetheless around the world taken heart from this example. And there's a woman in India that's building a women's mosque, sick and tired of the rule there where women aren't even allowed into the mosque at all. Women have become imams in Morocco, only to other women, but nonetheless become leaders in their community. And all around the world, the conversation has at least begun with institutional changes such as mosque in San Francisco, where the president literally tore down the wall behind which women were expected to sit.
Wow.
And so, you know, I'm an immigrant to this country who grew up in the 70s and 80s learning to be a strong, powerful citizen of the world. And I am taking those lessons back into my community. And that's what I think, you know, this American Muslim immigrant scene can uniquely do. And hopefully, you know, basically throw off the incredible news of these traditions like honor killings and you know, hatred and intolerance that I don't think we have to accept as a theology.
Why do you think we don't hear more stories like yours in the media?
Well, you know, I think that I've been a journalist for 20 years now, and I believe that Muslims, too, have to take responsibility for something like this. Like, we can blame, you know, the media all we want and not picking up these stories. I mean, violence and extremism sells much better than peace and love. But we got to sell our own stories. We got to actually challenge conventional wisdom and status quo so that the stories that actually make it into the media, I know from being a journalist, are ones in which there's actual action. And all of the rhetoric, all of the press releases, all of the petitions are interesting for a day. But story, like, we always have to have action. And so that's what I knew I had to do. I couldn't just, like, as a writer, argue that women have to have their rightful place. Like, I had to take my rightful place. And in that same way, that's the kind of action that I think the world is waiting for us to do in our communities, where we challenge these ideologies, where we force books that preach, you know, intolerance out of the mosque libraries. And I don't think we're doing enough of that, because I know from our own community experience, it's like becoming an early civil rights activist in the South. You have to deal with intimidation, isolation, all of the tactics of basically silencing any dissent. And there aren't a lot of people who I think want to sacrifice that in their own lives. They've got their children to marry off. They've got to get recommendations for their kid when they want to go to medical school. They've got, you know, this extended family network that doesn't want anybody to be out there on a limb and embarrass the family. And I've been really lucky because I've got parents who are completely supportive of taking a position. No, you know, I was hesitant on coming on your show because I understand that in the politics of the day, the Savage Nation has been put on one side and Muslims on the other side. But, you know, I really believe that it's really important for all of us to talk together. I don't take personal offense to things that you say or even have any kind of sensibility that you don't have a right to say any of that. Because at the end of the day, like, I feel like if people speak from rage or annoyance about any issue in a community, we've got to deal with it. Like, we really need to examine where that rage, where that irritation comes from, and actually do something about it, and not just try to silence people, but actually try to change our own community so that we can actually address people's fears, their worries, their own sensibilities.
Astra Nomani, thank you. Thank you. Keep up your incredible fight. And thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks for having me on, Michael. Savage.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me home.
It is Rock and Roll Tuesday on the Savage Nation. Not enough of politics. It's enough already. It's enough, enough, enough already. 1-800-449-8255. MichaelSavage.com. I mean, look, it's a dirge, the whole thing. I was just thinking during the break of the ads. Here it is, a convention that has no meaning whatsoever. Even if you're a liberal, this is a waste of time and money. Think of the homeless that could be fed with this money. Think of the blind children that could be given vitamin A. I mean, think of anything you want to do with the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being thrown around for this convention, the planning, the waste of human energy. You know, conventions are a 19th century institution that came about before there was even a telephone. Think about what I said. Delegates came from around the country to talk because they couldn't communicate by phone, and they talked about who they're going to elect and the planks, and they fought over it. This institution is as dead as the horse and buggy. It's time to end it. Nobody believes a word anyone's saying. It's nothing but a bad party. It's ugly, it's boring, and it is, frankly, a waste of America's psyche. We have more to do, you know, with our lives than this nonsense. Anyway, if you want to talk politics, I'm open for business here on the Savage Nation. We'll go to WOR. James, what's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mike, I'm afraid of Obama and of the Democrats, but I'm even more afraid of John McCain. Because this guy and Bolton and Cheney and Rice, they're trying to foment a civil war in the Ukraine between the Catholic minority and the Orthodox majority. And it will
You lost me. First of all, I think John Bolton was the best U.N. Representative we ever had. In fact, he was so good that they fired him. How does Bolton get blamed for this?
Because he's telling everyone on talk radio and all across the nation a gigantic lie. The majority of Ukrainians, they took a poll, 68% were against NATO expansion. In fact, they hope once Putin's out of there to take the east and go back to Russia, because the eastern Ukraine...
Oh, you're saying they're saying that the Ukrainians want to join NATO, but you're saying the truth is they're not.
Nothing could be further from the truth. Bolton is a Catholic bigot, and the Western Ukraine...
Well, now, wait a minute. Come on. Please. Do we have to call him names? Thank you. I mean, I understand you're an intelligent man, and you probably know more about the area than I do. I do know that things have cooled down in the Caucasus for a while, and that's good, because Caucasians need to caucus in order to make sure that we don't cook into an overboil and have World War III. That's all. It's time for the Caucasians to turn down the heat on the caucuses here, because this has got to come to an end. That's all. Savage advice, hypocrisy, the Dems. What do I want to talk about now in the last? Oregon, Kevin, welcome. What's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, thank you for taking my call. I just have a quick request for Rock and Roll Friday. I don't want to talk anything but cars, food, and music. I am so sick of these politicians. I've had it. It's only the second night of this, and I'm done.
Of course. And even liberals are saying, even James Carville, as liberal as they get, is saying, what is going on here? Let me explain what is going on, Kevin, so we can get it out of our system and maybe do nothing but stories for the rest of the week. What is going on is both parties are functioning as though they're giant American corporations. And corporations, as you well know, are afraid of controversy. So they have clipped all the wings. They've thrown out anybody who's controversial. They're doing a vanilla centrist thing. It's like a sales meeting for a major American corporation. Let us say a beer company, a beverage company, a corporation like General Motors, which is going out of business. That's what these parties are like. They're like companies that are going out of business. If the Democrat Party were a car company, they'd be out of business. If the Republican if the Republican Party was a car company, they'd be out of business. Nobody is buying their product. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I can't say it on the air. It's all bull. It's just bull. Enough.
Am I allowed on Friday to read from my new book, Psychological Nudity?
I hope you do, Dr. Savage. It's payday, and I'm going to order my book on Friday.
Well, remember this, and I thank you. I just want to say this. You know, I hate to get too commercial here. If you order it any time between now and the end of, I think, October, you're not going to be billed until the book ships. I have set up a system that's amazing. You bill it on your credit card. You don't get paid. You don't pay it. It doesn't get billed to your card till it gets shipped. That's what I heard. And for those of you who don't do credit email, I don't know what to do yet. I haven't figured it out. I'm not that good a businessman. I'm working on it, but I'm not the business side of my family. I'm the creative artiste. I've always been ahead of my time in some ways, and frankly, a lunkhead in other ways. I'm not a good businessman. I never was. I am lucky that I have business people in the family who are much smarter than me. They know how to make a living. I shouldn't put myself down. I've always been able to put food on the table and keep everyone in good shape. But in terms of big, you know, successful, not me. Well, I shouldn't complain, whatever. Dead Man's Pants, Tippy the Mad Dog, Woodchuck Bill, Happy and Sad Cufflinks, When Pasta Was... I'm not in the mood to read a story right now. South Carolina, Jason, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, hi, Dr. Savage. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
Okay, what's on my mind is I don't trust a lot of doctors. I respect you with your PhD in nutrition, And I eat everything in moderation. I'm like you. I'm an omnivore. I like to eat meat once in a while.
Right.
Occasionally I eat something sweet. But the point is I'm 6'2". I weigh 225. I think that's a decent weight for somebody that's about 40, don't you? I mean,
are you large boned?
Well, the thing is, everybody, when they gain weight, they look like they're large boned. You know, it's hard.
Well, if someone looked at you, would they see someone who's like obese?
No. I don't weigh 300 pounds.
All right, so you're not on the obese side. You're just large and you carry your weight. Okay. First of all, I can't give medical advice for legal reasons, but to be honest with you, Jason, this obsession with losing weight, this obsession with having washboard abs is nonsense. The human body, sure, it looks great. We'd all like to look like that. But the stress that that body requires to achieve and maintain, I think counteracts any benefits that you might gain from losing weight. Moreover, I don't see any evidence that lean body mass is necessarily associated with longevity. I don't see any proof to that. Now, I'm not arguing that you should be fat and overweight. We understand that that's deadly to carry that around. The heart has to pump more. There are more arteries and veins, more arterioles. So you want to keep yourself in relatively good shape. But I'm saying when you go to the extreme of a very low body fat and you're constantly, constantly worrying about how you look and losing weight, you're creating a stress in your life that unto itself is difficult for the human being to bear with. You know, look at the Iraqi men. I'm very serious. They say that originally mankind originated in Mesopotamia. Now it's Africa. But look how men are built in Iraq. I mean, for guys who were suffering, they got quite a bean on them. They walk around there with those dirty nightshirts. They all have a gut on them. What are they eating day and night? And what's the longevity of the Iraqi? I mean, when you put aside the war and those who died in his torture chambers. I can guarantee you it's not that bad. They eat a nice mixed diet with a lot of lamb and a lot of vegetables. And that's it. They don't have to worry about whether they look like Superman. This is the Savage Nation. The Savage Nation exposed. The Savage Nation revealed. With God's will and your listenership, I'll be back.
Savage.